Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about materials science, materials chemistry. But we're going to go and have a little voyage as usual. We'll talk a little bit about uranium. We might touch on tantalum. How tantalizing. Who's the guest? The guest is Mae Nyman. She's a professor of chemistry and materials science at Oregon State University. And Mae, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith.
Tell me, we always like to start here at the beginning with a little bit of background on the guest. How does a wonderful lady like you become into a scientist?
Well, I grew up in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and my parents, they always wanted to do things that were educational, intellectual, or involved eating. So my father was a naturalist. He liked bird watching, taking walks in the woods. Going to museums naturally since we were near Washington, D.C. And I think these things had an impact. But the thing that I think had the biggest impact was seeing the rocks and mineral collection at the Smithsonian. I always loved rocks and minerals. And then when we would go...
Oh, those pretty crystals. Many, many people on this program, that's been a starting point. Just how magnificent were the different crystalline minerals.
Yeah, and you know, forget the Hope Diamond. It wasn't that. It was, you know, what I remember is the large purple amethyst crystals and the big yellow sulfur crystals. And then, you know, we extend it to when we go take our walks on the beach or in the woods or whatever. No, I didn't care about the trees. I cared about the rocks. And I would always pick up the rocks and take them home, put them in my pocket and take them home. And then my mother started taking a geology class at the local university, Mary Washington College at the time, and I went on field trips with her. So just a lot of exposure to the natural environment, and what I always gravitated towards was rocks.
But you didn't turn out to be a geologist.
Well, actually,
that seems a perfect beginning.
Exactly. So my undergraduate degree is in geology.
Ah.
And in high school, I took a class in marine science, and I learned about plate tectonics and, you know, how the continents fit together and the evidence for that. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. So putting that together with mineralogy, of course, you have geology. So that was my chosen major with a minor in journalism because I wanted to write for National Geographic. I mean, everybody.
Ah, so the whole
a lot of people have that dream. So, yeah, so writing and rocks and minerals were two passions. And so I did my degree in geology.
So chemistry and materials. What was the big changing
point? Oh, okay. So along the way, every geology major has to do something called field camp. And that's where you go out in the mountains someplace in the West. And I happened to go to the one at Northern Arizona University. So you get maps, you go out in the field, and you do your field mapping. And the whole time I was out in the field doing my field mapping, I was just too worried about getting lost. Or I would just sit down at an outcrop and look at the rocks closely and, you know, wonder about the minerals and what elements were present. I mean, I was still drawn back to the mineralogy and just decided that geology was
too big.
Exactly.
Get lost.
Yeah, I didn't like the big stuff, so it was a good way to ruin a nice walk.
I remember when I was a student in Durham in England, I was a minor in geology, and you know there'd always be the field trips. It wouldn't be very far, and on the other side of the Pennines, Lake District was a favorite place to go, and there'd always be some students that would pocket some fossil that he'd nicked from the geological sciences collection, and then wave it like mad. Look what I've found, Professor X.
Oh, yeah, you could really confuse a professor that way.
Well, no, you couldn't. I mean, they'd seen it all before.
They knew better, huh?
Anyway, so you got into materials and chemistry. How did that work? What do you specialize in, if you like?
I ended up doing a master's degree in materials engineering. And when I realized I didn't really like the big features in geology, the plate tectonics and all that, I got a minor in chemistry because mineralogy and inorganic chemistry are pretty similar. So I knew that was the way I was headed. I liked atoms and understanding what elements you have in the rocks changes the properties, you know, changes the color or the shape, that kind of thing. So I decided to do a PhD in inorganic chemistry.
And where did you do that? And what did you specialize in?
My PhD was at the University of New Mexico. So that was the 90s when semiconductor industry and thin films were really hot. So I was doing precursor chemistry to thin film materials.
And did it have any application? Did you get some patents or just the usual papers?
Yep, we got some patents on some zinc sulfide materials that were substituted with manganese, and these glow blue. So you've seen those night lights that you plug into. Those are manganese substituted zinc sulfide.
Did you make money out of this, or did your supervisor
the university? I've never made money off of a patent.
No. Did anybody?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
But at least it came into some form of fruition. I mean, blue night lights are sort of kind of nice to say you had a role in developing those, I suppose.
Well, they were already developed, but we...
Oh, so what did you do? Change their color?
It was more a different way to make them, a lower temperature way to make them.
Okay, so a more efficient way of doing things.
Yes.
All right. And then after that, you went to work where? You have to have a job after you get a PhD. So what did you do?
So I went to work at Sandia National Labs in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was there for 14 and a half years.
Doing what?
Well, I did a lot of different things. I initially worked on nuclear waste management. So we have all these chemical wastes left over from the bomb building era in the 1940s. And they're stored at places like Hanford and the Savannah River site. And what scientists' goal is to do is to remove the radioactive part and put that in a safe, solid form that you can store. And then you can dispose of the rest of it more easily. So I worked on projects to remove the radioactive parts from the non-radioactive parts.
And how does one go about doing that?
Well, there's different ways. You can precipitate them. You can absorb them onto materials that have pores that are just the right size and shape and chemistry to absorb them.
Did you develop some interesting technologies? I mean, clearly this is a very applied area. I mean, a lot of us sort of divide our time between applied science and really fundamental science. And what this seems to say is that the target is a big one, that is to sort of remediate the solutions or soils or whatever to get rid of radioactive materials. Did you get patents for this, for example?
Yes. In fact, this was one of my most successful patents. I worked with a colleague at the Savannah River site, and so we had a sorbent. It's mostly titanium dioxide.
That's the stuff you find in suntan lotions and other things.
It's
ubiquitous, in fact.
Yes, exactly. Well, it was actually more of a sodium titanate, and it absorbs radioactive strontium as well as neptunium and plutonium. And we improved on the chemistry of this material so it could absorb it faster and more selectively. And we did patent this, and that was in about 2006. And to this date, the Savannah River site is still testing it and considering using it to remove these radionuclides, these radioactive elements from their nuclear wastes.
Which is an interesting feature because you did this many years ago and yet they're still in the process of evaluating and testing.
So yes. I mean,
to actually use materials for this business of removing radioactive nuclei, a lot of testing goes into this. I mean, it takes a long time between the idea, proving the idea works, and then using the technology.
That's right. Yeah, you need to be very patient as a scientist. You need to do your thing and then move on, and then many years later you might get a pleasant surprise. Because they test things that you would never even think of. So first of all, so in my laboratory, I make, a little bit, a few grams, and they need to make tons of it for starters, and then they need to make sure by scaling up the reaction, does it still work? And then there's all kinds of things like after you absorb the radioactive elements onto it, you go and filter it. So what sort of problems are there? And then they need to convert the titanate, the titanium dioxide, with the absorbed radioactive elements into a safe form. So how does that process work? And just so many steps and so many details that different scientists with different expertise need to work out before they can actually use the material.
I remember several years, about 10 years ago, I had a contract with Los Alamos to make extractants, things that bind to plutonium and americium and things like that. And I thought, oh, this is going to be nice, you know, I'll make a few grams. And it wasn't until I got to the end of the sort of contract where I read that they want 1 kilogram, you know, for an academic scientist. A kilogram is just like, wow, that's an awful lot. But we managed to do it anyway. Let's go back to the sodium titanate. Titanium oxide, it's a white pigment. And as I say, it's used all over for whitening. What is it that was special about the sodium titanate? That means that you've now got an ionic compound. Was it an ion exchange process, or how did these other metals get absorbed onto the material?
Well, it is an ion exchange process. So the titanium dioxide part is actually in layers, mm-hmm. so sheets. And in between these sheets is sodium and water. And the sodium exchanges out for the other radioactive elements, the strontium and the actinide. And the chemical improvement that we made, we don't understand exactly what the effect is to this day. So, you know, there's two parts of science. There's the part that I described, making tons of it and testing all the little details to make sure that it works and, you know, there's no disasters there. And then there's the other part. Okay, so we fortuitously made it work better. Now can we understand why it works better, and therefore in the future when we have similar problems that we want to solve.
You've got a plan.
Yes, exactly. We can do it not fortuitously, but with foresight and intelligence. But then, of course, we would go and do that, and we would discover something different altogether. And that's the way science is. It always surprises you.
In hindsight, do you know what it was that you did that was fortuitous when you made a different form, if you like, of the titanate, or a different method of making it?
To this day, we still don't know. It takes some very specialized techniques to study it, and once again, we need to be patient. We haven't had the time or money to study it. But we did learn, this reminds me of something else, uranium. So another thing that this material did is it would not absorb the uranium. So the improved form did not absorb the uranium. The part that wasn't improved did absorb. So it's a precursor or prototype did absorb uranium.
Now, scientists love that dilemma. That and, really is interesting.
Well, this actually turns out to be a very good thing because of the radioactive elements in the nuclear waste in the Savannah River site, most of these radioactive elements are uranium. But they're not so concerned about removing the uranium. They're more concerned about removing the plutonium and neptunium. So what are
improved— And because they have longer lives and they're more persistent and more dangerous, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor May Nyman from Oregon State University. And we're talking about uranium waste, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. During the presidential election, we learned that Ann Romney, wife of the Republican candidate, had a flare-up of multiple sclerosis, or MS. It forced her to cut back her campaign efforts.
It also spotlighted the disease, which is the most common nervous disorder in the U.S. and is caused by an autoimmune response. That's when the body's immune system attacks itself, in particular the myelin sheath covering parts of the nerve cell.
We don't know what causes MS, but it's progressive and can impede functions such as walking, vision, and bowel movements.
Now researchers believe a new MS drug tones down the autoimmune response. The drug, diclizumab, decreases a unique type of immune cell that normally promotes lymph node development in the fetus, but may now be connected to MS.
The cells, lymphoid tissue inducer cells, or LTI cells, decreased when patients took diclizumab. They also had less inflammation in the fluid surrounding the brain and spinal column.
The drug lowers inflammation by blocking a molecule called interleukin-2 and activates natural killer cells that also help suppress the immune response.
From the study's results, researchers believe that by blocking interleukin-2, diclizumab may be acting on a type of stem cell. This encourages the stem cells to produce more natural killer cells than LTI cells, reducing the inflammation and the damage that happens in MS.
More studies will have to confirm the role of LTI cells in MS. Developing drugs to target them will do even more to slow the progression of this disease.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, May Nyman from Oregon State University. We were just talking about trying to remove radioactive materials from aqueous environments, et cetera, et cetera, and how fortuitous or serendipity can often sort of come in, be useful. But still, after all this time, then, you really don't have a really clever idea of what made the difference between uranium being adsorbed, not adsorbed, and then the others being adsorbed in a better manner.
Well, we actually know why the uranium does not get absorbed. And this has led to another project that I'm currently working on uranium chemistry. So the improvement that we made on this material was quite simple. You just add peroxide, hydrogen peroxide, the stuff that you can buy in the supermarket to bleach your hair or clean out your wounds. So when you add peroxide to titanium, this peroxide molecule bonds to the titanium, and you know it's there because it turns yellow. So titanium dioxide is white, as you said. It's in sunscreen. But if it has peroxide, it's yellow. So uranium very much likes to bond to peroxide. And if the solutions are like the nuclear waste, they're very alkaline. They have very high pH, which is the opposite of acidic. So uranium, in the presence of these peroxide molecules in very high pH, they dissolve. So the uranium was likely actually plucking the peroxide off the material, and then they form these spherical, these ball-like structures, which contain 20, 30 uranium atoms, and we call these clusters. And maybe nanomaterials, you can call them nanomaterials. And so for the past 3-4 years, I've been involved with a project with a group of scientists. So the Obama administration, when they first came to office, they created these Energy Frontier Research Centers. And there's 42 of them funded across the nation. And
there's a cluster of these then.
Yeah. So each one is focused on a different alternative energy. So developing the foundational science for this energy. So obviously the one that I'm involved on is for nuclear energy. So we are understanding actinide chemistry for the application of nuclear energy. So if you want to use nuclear materials for energy, you have to be concerned about many things. So you start out with your nuclear fuel pellets. You want to reprocess them so you can reuse as much of the material as you can without creating a great amount of wastes. And then you do need to worry about disposing of wastes. So this is the nuclear fuel cycle. You want to close the cycle.
So in now, Oregon State University, then, you have this whole package, this whole center focused on nuclear energy.
Oh no!
Bits and pieces that go with it, or no?
It's led by Notre Dame University. It's led by Peter Burns at Notre Dame University, and there's people from University of California and Oak Ridge National Labs, and I worked.
So when you say centers, and there's many of them,
they're virtual.
Okay, so
they're virtual. They're multi-institutional.
Right.
Big collaborative projects.
Okay. Is that working out well? I mean, virtual centers. I know it's the current methodology for funding. I mean, we've got one here at the University of Texas at El Paso on solar energy, which involves Santa Barbara, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that this is the way of the future, or is it just an experiment that might sort of revert later on to more tangible, not so much virtuality to it?
Yeah, well, obviously the idea is everybody has their specialty.
Right.
But to really get something done, you need to bring these specialties together and work collaboratively. And I have to say it's enormous fun, and everybody works hard at making it happen. So I think it's a very positive thing for both the development of science. And another focus is developing young scientists. So there's this idea that or this concern that actinide chemists are disappearing from the world.
And not because they're working with actinides, just
right.
because they're getting older. I mean, the Manhattan Project was the 30s and 40s. You know, some of the people that are left over from that, I guess there aren't any. But it's an old generation that's been doing this work.
Yes.
So you're part of the new, young, bright generation of actinide scientists.
Well, not so young, but the people that work under me, the students that I train, are
right.
part of the – they're the future actinide chemists. So uranium. So more than 95% of these fuel pellets are composed of uranium. So it's very important to understand many aspects of uranium chemistry. So we are studying these very beautiful spherical structures of uranium with peroxide molecules, and how they behave in water, how they form, how they unform.
Let me just sort of interject there. I mean, the audience out there will know the concept of ionic bonding. Everybody knows sodium chloride.
Sure.
Everybody knows that forms a sodium positive cation and a chlorine negative anion.
Okay.
Now, you get to things like uranium. There are many more possibilities because, you know, uranium has many what we call oxidation states. You can have monopositive, that's remove one electron, two, three, and then there's this famous uranyl anion, which is UO2,
yes.
all 2+.
Yep.
Now, do you know these clusters? Are you clear that you understand what the so-called oxidation state? Are all the uraniums the same in this cluster area?
Yes. In fact, the uranyl that you're talking about, UO2, so the uranium has two oxygens bonded to it, and they form a line. So like carbon dioxide, so you have oxygen, uranium. Oxygen, and it is exactly this structural feature that allows them to form these hollow spheres. So they're actually hollow. So those oxygens that are bonded on the outside, so the uraniums line up perpendicular to the spherical part. So if you think of the Earth, analogy is the Earth. So let's say the Earth is our spherical uranium oxide particle, and you think about trees growing out. So the oxygen is the tree pointing up. That's one oxygen. And then the second one points down. It's the roots. And these oxygens don't like to bond to anything else strongly. So this is why the cluster can form. So that oxygen sticking out does not necessarily bond to another uranium and precipitate uranium oxide. It's what we call inert. So it doesn't react. It
They're like my cells.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Sense,
it's very similar to my cells.
Right. And in the middle of these clusters is just water.
There's all kinds of things. There's alkali cations. So you mentioned sodium.
Okay.
You can have sodium inside. Whatever alkali you use, you know, cesium, potassium, lithium, whatever
okay,
you
so
use to make.
This is a really complicated system.
And there's water.
Now, you can't possibly get these in the solid form to get crystal structures.
Oh, yes. We have plenty of crystal structures, yes.
Of these large
yes.
spherical arrays with other materials inside,
yes,
including water.
And they form all kinds of beautiful geometries. There's always peroxide molecules present. This is what allows them to bend to make the spherical shape. Otherwise, they would make flat sheets. But the peroxide ligand, due to the interaction of the electrons of those peroxide molecules and those inert oxygens bonded to the uranium, they interact so you get bending, and this is what allows the formation of the spherical structure. And there's something like over 60 structures, all different shapes and sizes published, and many of them from Peter Burns.
Now this is what you're currently working on?
Yes, and I am.
So you want to make the 61st and the 62nd?
I mean, well, I'm studying more what happens when you dissolve them back into water, and how the water and the alkalis inside exchange, and actually how they form.
And the reason for that is what?
Well,
what will you? How would you apply that once you've learned how they form or why?
Well,
conditions.
Coming back to the nuclear fuel cycles, so we want to be able to separate uranium from other things, impurities, daughter ions from decay of the uranium and the plutonium, and so on. So we need to understand many things about how to dissolve, separate, and precipitate uranium
from all this other stuff. Sort of the engineering part of it. You understand the chemistry, and therefore you allow yourself to more elaborate and refine the process when you use it for separations.
Yes, but there's a lot of wonderful chemistry to learn along the way. So that's the beauty of these Energy Frontier Research Centers is it is supposed to be fundamental chemistry directed towards alternative energies.
Supposing someone at the University of Texas at El Paso, University of New Mexico, suddenly came up with some clever ideas on uranium chemistry. Is it possible that you can get into one of these centers as an adjunct and, you know, and use your expertise to add to the core, or is it so fixed?
It's actually fairly flexible. I mean, academicians are very flexible, and so I've collaborated with people inside the center who are officially a part of it, and I've also developed new collaborations with other people studying uranium for different reasons, where, you know, they have their funding and focus and I have mine, but we have a mutual interest in uranium chemistry, and we come together and work together. So you can do both.
You know, just a couple of weeks ago, we did a program from Urenco. This is the Uranium Enrichment Corporation or company, and Eunice, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Gregory Smith, who was the sort of chief officer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing that in a little town of Eunice, New Mexico, which has got a population of 1,400, they provide over 30% of the enriched uranium for North America.
Wow.
So this uranium is big business in this area.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's mined here. Scientific history here and political history and possibly a future.
Where do you see the end of your rainbow, if you like, on this particular project? Is simply to facilitate the public's feeling safe with uranium so more nuclear power stations can be built? Nuclear energy is not just technology. It's also sociology. You've got to convince people that nuclear fuel is the right way to go.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know what the answer to that is. People definitely have a fear of radioactive materials.
Our producer says we've run out of time, May Nyman. So we may not continue.
So we're not going to talk about tantalizing tantalum.
No. We'll save that for another program. But anyway, May Nyman, Associate Professor of Materials and Chemistry at Oregon State University, thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. Thanks, Norma Martinez, for putting it together so it sounds as wonderful as it does. And we will be back next week with another program. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Texas Tech Paul L. Foster School of Medicine is having a Hop for Health 5K run and 1 mile fun walk. Organizers are now signing up sponsors as well as participants. The event takes place March 24th at Escondite Park in South Central El Paso. Read more under the calendar at Synapse, the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.